we're going to be there tonight. So here we are at the last study of this quarter, and we're going to try and wrap up a few lessons that we've been able to spend in the book of Philippians this last month. So Philippians chapter 4, and we'll try to pick up with verse 8 and just try to look at some things down through the end of the chapter, and then maybe talk, if we got time, talk a little bit about the book in review. And some impressions and some applications some takeaways before we finish up. So Philippians 4, verses 8 and 9, of course, very familiar to a lot of us. This is verse 8's a memory verse in a lot of Bible classes. Paul says, "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence, and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. The things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you." And that's really kind of the end of the instruction part of the epistle, and Paul's going to turn attention to some personal matters. Not that those aren't instructive too, but turn some attention to that afterwards. So, first of all, I want you to think about the end of verse 8. Dwell on these things. Think on these things is the rendering in a lot of translations. But of course, what Paul wants us to do is not just give them a momentary thought, or a passing, okay, I'm thinking about true things, now I'm going to go think of something else. But the idea is taking account of something and really focusing my mind on it. And of course, what he's going to say in verse 9 is not only, we're not only looking at some things to think about, we're looking at some things to act on. And so as we consider these ideas and ideals that verse 8 sets forth, let's think about it that way, that these are supposed to be the focus of our thoughts with a view toward becoming all that those things suggest, and building our lives around these kinds of ideals. We talked about that just a little bit, actually, in our lesson Sunday night about guarding our hearts. We actually mentioned this passage. Shane?
Well, we think about the word dwell on something. In today's day and age, we almost use it with a negative connotation. And sometimes, right. Sometimes it is. You know, if someone has something unhealthy that they keep dwelling on, it's that idea that they're obsessing about it. They won't let it go. And that can be harmful, but in this case,
yeah, yeah, exactly. It depends on what you dwell on, right? Yeah, sure. Just a couple of notes. Paul uses a couple of words in this verse that he doesn't use anywhere else. He uses a couple of words that don't pop up anywhere else in the New Testament, and he uses several expressions that were often found in lists of virtues, even by pagan moralists. But to the Greeks, to philosophers, to pagans, these were philosophical virtues. Paul isn't talking about philosophy. He's talking about our relationship to God. He's talking about a mindset. Not real surprising that you're going to find a lot of the same ideas and ideals that are set forth here. But Paul puts them in a more important context, really. So, first of all, whatever is true, and Paul's word just means that, just like we would, that which conforms to fact
and reality. All right?
And by extension, truthfulness, integrity, reliability of character. When this was used of a person, and we use it that way sometimes too. You know, when we say, we usually follow it up with some kind of noun. But when we say a person is true, what do we mean about them? Okay, we mean they're sincere, and sometimes we mean they're reliable. They are trustworthy. They can be counted on. Not just that they correspond to reality. So, question, first of all, just when we're talking about things that are factually true, that correspond to reality, why is it important for me? And some of these questions you're gonna be thinking to yourself, why is he asking such a basic question like that? Why is it important for me to set my mind on things that are true? Okay, all right. Okay. What goes in comes out. Yeah. Okay, all right. I mean, I don't think we ever intentionally say, I think I'm going to believe something false today. We don't do that. I think I'm just going to accept as true something that I know to be false. The human mind doesn't generally work that way. Ryan, go ahead.
Was it David Tomley that was here with this meeting and he talked about the truth a little bit?
I think so.
He mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of things that we kind of assume or we pretty sure about, but we don't really know the truth. And I think sometimes this is, you know, like you said, no one's thinking, I need to think about some false things today. But sometimes we assume a lot of truth. Okay. And Paul's saying, you know, there's some things you know to be true, who God is, who Jesus is, and what they're about. That's what you know to be true. Really kind of think about those things, and not stuff that is periphery to that or might be true or sounds good because it might be true, but what you really know is true.
Okay, all right. Very good. You think Paul is primarily concerned with thinking about things that are that mathematical truths or what we would call scientific truths? I don't mean to dismiss the importance of any of those things. You think that's what Paul's got in mind? Whatever is true?
Satan's the father of lies.
Okay.
He tells lots of lies that he would like for us to believe. And sometimes we do believe, and that's our detriment.
Okay. I mean, I've got to think that Paul's chief concern is going to be truth in the spiritual realm. Truth about spiritual matters. And of course, if you were to ask Paul, where does that come from? Do we just intuit that through philosophy? How do we get there? How do we arrive at that truth? Okay. The Word of God. That's why Paul does what he does. That Word he would say to the Corinthians has been entrusted to him as a ministry, as a charge. All right. So let's use the extended idea of truth as it's applied not to things that conform to objective reality, but to people. What kind of person am I seeking to be? Well, I'm seeking to be a true person. Okay, what does that mean? I'm seeking to manifest truth in my life. How's that going to affect the way I look? The way I act and the way I talk, maybe the way I look.
There'll be no hypocrisy.
Okay.
In the way that you live.
Okay. All right. Free. Yeah. Sure. Freedom. Free from hypocrisy. Yeah. Wait.
Whatever is true, of course, as you've been saying, is the truth. It is opposite of that which is false, which is a lie. So, be true. Be truthful in everything that you do.
Okay. All right. All right. See, we start with one that's one of those questions that you're like, doesn't everybody know the answer to this? Why are we even talking about that? Again, what I'm trying to emphasize is that Paul doesn't just want us to think about things or about ideas. He wants us to do that. But he wants us to think about those things with a view toward how it will affect our character, how it will affect who we are. So whatever is true, whatever is honorable, second word. Anybody got a different word than honorable?
Worthy of respect.
Worthy of respect, okay. You think anything else?
Noble.
Noble, okay. All right. And that's what Paul's word means. Something that's worthy of honor, worthy of praise, worthy of esteem. And again, when it's applied to a person, it means somebody who is dignified in character, somebody who's respectable and reputable. And you'll see, by the way, some of these ideas will overlap, as you often find when Paul lists things. In 1 Timothy 3 and verse 8, when Paul is talking about elders in the local church, he uses this term to describe their the respectability or dignity that is required of a man who would serve in that role. It's also used of as a requirement for the wives of deacons, 1 Timothy 3, verse 11, and it's applied to older men in Titus 2 and verse 2. This is the kind of person we are seeking, especially seeking to grow into being. Honorable. So when you think about when I say something is honorable as opposed to dishonorable, give me an example of that. Because we want to think about the kinds of things I need to focus my attention on versus the kind of things that I might want to avoid in considering this list.
Talking about here in spiritual matters, you know, if you get caught up in some sin and sinful behavior, you know, that's dishonorable. You know, if you live a righteous life, that's living a life of honor. It's an honorable life, and you're an honorable person if you can follow the teachings of God accurately.
Okay.
It is our core makeup. It is where we live. It is who we truly, deep down, we're not shouting. We are deep down what we should be.
Okay.
And that is honorable all the way to the bone.
Okay. All right. To go back to something we said earlier, do you think even pagans in Paul's day had a concept of what it means to be honorable? You talk to a person today who's an atheist, they can still tell you they have a concept of what it means to be an honorable person. What do we mean by that, Jay?
When he was talking to the Corinthians, the first letter to the Corinthians, talking about the man that had his father's wife, he's a Gentile.
Good example, yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, even rank pagans viewed that as a bridge too far. In sexual conduct, and we're talking about a culture with a lot of very loose morals when it came to that. Okay, yeah, good. It is almost universal among human beings to idealize being truthful, forthright, non-hypocritical, honest in our dealings with one. Even if the people themselves are not that way, they recognize that that's how a person ought to be. Okay. And you're going to find that with a lot of the things on this list. Even people who, in big ways, don't live up to these standards, they recognize these are the standards you ought to be pursuing. As was true, would have been true in Paul's day as well. Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is, what's our next word? Well, it's going to depend on what translation you have. Okay. All right. Commendable. Just is the word in a lot of translations. Commendable. Some translations just say whatever is right. Okay. All right. That's all right. Okay. We'll come back to commendable because that is a good translation of another term. Okay. Again, a lot of overlap between these ideas. Paul is not meaning to pigeonhole the, you know, this into rigid categories necessarily. So whatever is right or just, the word means, again, when it's applied to people, which is usually how it's applied, somebody who is righteous, upright, somebody who lives according to the rules. Or if you want to apply it to concepts, it's that which is according to the rules, to the standard of what's right. Well, for Paul, for the Christians in Philippi, what's the standard of what's right? Is it just whatever's going on in their own consciences at the moment? Okay. Let me go back to our first word for a minute. This is something I should have talked about. You hear a lot of people in our modern world talk about, I have to speak and live my truth, they will say. And sometimes when there is a disagreement, well, you have to live your truth and I have to live mine. Okay. And that is just, I'll be honest, that is just a mauling of the English language. It really creates really sloppy things. You can't have your truth and my truth. You can have your opinion and my opinion, your beliefs, your values and my values. Truth is a different matter. And the same is true with what is right, what is just. People generally recognize what is right, even though they don't. Let me give you an example. Will you find people who will defend lying in certain circumstances? Of course they will. You think those same people will resent it very much when somebody else lies to them? Find people who will justify stealing in certain circumstances? Sure. You think they get mad when somebody steals from them? I want to suggest that that's more than just, you know, the shoes on the other foot or any of that. I think deep down that's a recognition that those things are objectively wrong, even though we often fail to live up to that. So whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right. Again, when this term is applied to people in the broadest sense, it's being upright, it's being virtuous. It's the kind of word that you find a lot in the New Testament to describe a person who keeps the commands of God, who lives uprightly. In fact, sometimes it's used in the sense of someone or something that is approved by God. It's akin to the words to the word righteousness in the New Testament. It's also akin to the word justification that Paul uses a lot in Romans. Those are all related terms in the New Testament. Shane?
I can remember a few years ago, there was a person that I knew and she was bragging on how happy she was to be able to raise her kids. I forget exactly how she put it, but basically raise them in a moral home devoid of God. And my question to her was, well, where does the standard of morality come from? You know, do you get to set the standard? You know, if you negate God, whose standard counts?
Right.
There has to be a source of truth, a source of authority, a source of morality that comes from. Otherwise, your morality is not mine. You know, same sense of morality.
Yeah, I think that's right, and that's one of the things we always have to be mindful of. Anytime we're talking to people who, you know, either question or deny the existence of God, when the issue of morality comes up, either there is a standard of morality or there isn't. Obviously, if I'm not a believer in God, then I'm going to devolve to, well, morality is what society defines it to be. Okay, well, yeah. You see any potential problems there?
Yeah.
Okay, what?
I need to kill somebody today, but there's a wide spectrum of
Okay, sure. All right, yeah, okay. I mean, sometimes it devolves onto, well, as long, you know, as long as it's not illegal, then it's right. Do moral standards, at least to some degree, differ from one society to another, one culture to another? They can. If we reduce it even smaller to the individual, do moral standards differ from one person to another? You know, if they're not basing it on something outside themselves. I imagine this is something Doy's going to talk about in his Mind Your Faith series at some point, because it's a big issue. And it's something that a person who is an atheist at some point has to confront. Where's your, you know, if one of the big objections that sometimes, I'm getting a little off base here, I know, that atheism will lodge against God is that, you know, the complaint that God isn't good. Well, how do you define what is good if there's no objective standard of what is good? Those are the problems that we really need to confront people with. What's the next word? Whatever is pure. I don't think our translations differ much there. Whatever is pure. This is akin to the word for holy in the New Testament. Something that's undefiled. Something that is. Sometimes it means something that's sacred. With regard to people, very often it has to do with proper motives. In the Christian sense, something or someone, in this case, that's centered on God. You see how many of these words are used not just of abstract concepts, but they are applied to human character. And that's really what we want to focus on. I think that's what Paul wants us to, what God wants us to focus on as Paul writes this. Whatever is pure, the word Thayer defines it in his inimitable way, exciting reverence, venerable, sacred, pure. Sometimes it's used pure from carnality, modest, chaste, pure from fault. Okay, free of contaminants. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we understand the idea of purity even in chemistry. And other kinds of things, something that's pure is free from contaminants, it's unalloyed, whatever you want. Yeah, sure. Okay. And the Bible talks a lot about moral purity. Sometimes it'll talk about being clean in very much the same kind of way. Are there a lot of, back up just a minute. Are there a lot of not honorable, not just, not pure kinds of things competing for my attention in the modern world? Things inviting me to focus my attention. Okay, why is it that I'm tempted by those things? Okay, yeah. There's something, it's packaging, it's marketing. Okay. There's some appeal to some desire or other. Yeah. And we've already talked, when we talked about guarding our hearts Sunday night, we talked about the fact that sometimes it doesn't take a lot of exposure for us to be affected by the things that we allow into our minds. Maybe without even realizing it. I think especially of entertainment, because entertainment packaging can normalize a kind of behavior presented as something that's harmless. The character who does these things is, they're not a terrible, awful person. They're a good person. They just, they do this one thing that's, most people acknowledge is bad. But is it really so bad if such a nice person is involved in that? And you subject yourself enough of it and you start thinking, what is that? Is that really so bad? Why should I think that's so bad? And then you come back to, well, because God defines it as sin. That's why. But it's very easy to have. It's very easy, at least if you're like me, to catch yourself having your thinking altered a little, altered bit by bit, by the things you're exposed to. That's, I think, part of the reason, even though the Philippians didn't have television or the internet or even radio or anything like that, Paul's still reminding them, be mindful of what you spend your time thinking about, the things that you allow to enter into your mind and shape your heart. Because, as you know, Shane pointed out, eventually that is going to come out. It is going to affect who you are on the outside. Whatever is pure, what's our next word? Whatever is lovely. Okay. Are we talking about whatever is visually appealing? Because a lot of times that's the sense in which we use the word. You know, that's a lovely paint. Okay. Is that what Paul means? What do you think? Okay, all right, all right. The word means something that's pleasing, something that's agreeable, something that's acceptable. It's attractive in a moral sense, the idea. It's not that it's physically attractive. It's that it draws our affection because it is right. Again, see how interconnected and overlapping a lot of these ideas are. That which is lovable by its nature, one writer said. Now, again, the problem is that, you know, people train themselves to love all kinds of things, and some of them really aren't very lovely. But Paul invites us to think, okay, if it's agreeing, pleasing, acceptable, not just to me, but to God, then that's what I need to set my mind on. Whatever is of good repute, good report is the old King James word, okay? That's your commendable. Okay, yeah, and that's a good word. This is the word, by the way, that Paul uses the word from which we get our word euphemism. It means to, it's from the word that means well and the words that means, basically a spoken or a report news. And in, like in pagan Greek circles, the word would convey a good omen, a positive omen, or maybe the speaking of good words at, say, someone's death to avoid any ill omen. Of course, when we use a euphemism, we mean one of two things. Taking a vulgar, what we call four-letter words, and substituting a slightly less offensive term. But we also use the word euphemism to take a more pleasant-sounding term to describe an ugly reality. We're familiar with the concept, but that's not really what Paul has in mind. He has in mind whatever is well spoken of. Whatever is commendable, whatever is admirable. I want you to look at a contrast in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 8, just for a moment. So starting in verse 4 of 2 Corinthians 6, in everything we commend ourselves as servants of God, and he lists a bunch of things, in much endurance and afflictions and hardships and distresses, beatings, imprisonment, so on and so forth. Down to verse 8, Paul says we are commending ourselves by glory and dishonor, by evil report and good report. And he uses basically Greek words that mean the opposite, but they're both from the same root. And it's the good report is basically the same term that he uses in Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. Whatever is well spoken of. Okay. Well, is it possible in our world for something to be well spoken of that I as a Christian should want nothing to do with? Sure it is. Okay. So many of these ideas go back to the idea of conformity to the divine standard, and that's what makes the difference for them. That, you know, that whatever is pure as God defines it, whatever is lovely that's in agreement with God's standard, whatever is of good repute, because it ought to be of good repute. It's kind of the underlying assumption in this text. We're not just going after whatever most people in the culture think is good or pure or true or lovely or whatever. If there is any excellence and anything worthy of praise, these last two one writer said we need to consider them as comprehensive terms involving every possible moral value. Excellence is excellence, especially of a moral nature. 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5, add to your faith moral virtue, is what a lot of our translations say. Peter uses the same word here, same word there. Worthy of praise is just, Paul just says, whatever is praise, really. But it denotes what is deserving of praise. Now again, I'll ask one more time. Are we thinking about these concepts just because they're abstract concepts that are good to think about? Is that what Paul is pushing us toward? What does God, through Paul, want us to do with these things? Why are we to think on them and dwell our minds on them? What's that about? Right?
They impact our life and how we act and how we think beyond that. So you have to think on these things because they will change the way you think about the world to be more in line with how God thinks about the world.
Okay, yeah. Very, very well said, yeah. Okay, Shane? Sure. Yeah. Very good.
I almost see this as kind of an upward spiral toward his thesis of rejoice in the Lord.
Yeah.
This is the pyramid on which an attitude of gratitude is built. And you don't get to that pinnacle by stinking thinking and
right.
Down the toilet bowl.
Right. Okay, yeah, very good, yeah. Much like we encounter in Jesus' teaching in the Gospels, what Paul very often emphasizes and his parting plea to the Philippians is essentially, don't just focus on acting a certain way. Focus on thinking a certain way. Focus on thinking about certain things and imbuing your character with certain things, dwelling your mind on certain things that you know will shape your attitude and your outlook to be in conformity with what God desires. And I think you're exactly right. There's an indispensable connection between that and the joy that Paul keeps commanding over and over in this letter. How do I find that? Well, I'm not going to find that by filling my mind with junk. Sure, go ahead.
It's very parallel kind of structure to what he uses in 1 Timothy, where he's talking in 1 Timothy 4, let no one despise your youth, and he goes into this practice the spiritual gifts, which is like called a meditation on good things.
Mm-hmm.
Very parallel structure.
Yeah, yeah.
You can tell us the same author. Same song, different
person. Yeah, okay. Verse 9, and I'll tell you right now, I'm not really competent to comment on the intricacies of the Greek text here, but some folks who are say there really is a connection between verses 8 and 9 that kind of gets obscured in most of our translations. And in essence, Paul would believe Paul is saying all these things in verse 8, think on these things that you have learned and received and heard and seen in me. It's not just think on these things as abstractions. It's you've seen this at work. I have showed you this at work. I have taught you about these things, and I have tried to demonstrate these things. And so he says, verse 9, what does he tell us to do? Practice them. Yeah. Go ahead, Mike.
Thoughts lead to actions, and actions lead to outcomes. I think that's the connection between 8 and 9 is you think on these things. Verse 9, you do these things, and the outcome is God peace is with you. And, you know, so our thoughts do shape who we are. And we are called to be sacred, holy people. And these are the kind of things that sacred, holy people think about. Otherwise we're just
okay, very good, very good. All right. And to wrap up verse 9, Paul says, if we will do that, if we will dwell our mind on these things, if we will practice these things, what end result should we expect? Well, the God of peace will be with you. And I think by that joy that Paul has been... I mean, everybody wants joy, and Paul says a lot in Philippians about where that joy comes from, and it's not in the places that people are so often pursuing it. All right. Yeah. Yeah, the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. If you, verse 6, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, make your requests known to God. Okay. Because I mean, anxiety, fear, worry, you know, those are opposite kinds of things to what we read on the list in verse 8. They are things we all deal with. Are things we all confront. The question is, am I going to, you know, fill my mind and my heart up with that? Very easy to do that. And you can find people who will feed it. You can find all kinds of sources who will feed those things. Or, Paul says, you can focus your mind on it. Okay. Doy? Very good. Yes, I would agree. Okay. Other thoughts, comments before we kind of get to some of the somewhat more personal kinds of things at the end of this letter? Yeah, Marcos, go ahead.
What you get to say is the kind of peace that you get from having these things abiding, by putting those things into practice.
What? How would I describe the kind of peace? Well, Paul says it's beyond all comprehension, so I can't describe it. No, I'm sorry. You opened the door. I had to walk through it. Let me throw that back to all of you. What is this peace? I mean, how would you... Because I'm assuming a lot of us here understand what it is. We experience it. Does this mean that your life never has any problems? Let's ask that first. Is that the peace that surpasses all comprehension mean that I never have a bad day?
Okay.
And yet, in the middle of lions attacking, devouring, and pursuing you, there is Hollywood analogy would be this Tom Cruise kind of ability to just somehow, or you know, whatever the somehow you're making it through insurmountable odds.
Okay. Okay, and we ask one more time, where is Paul when he writes this letter? Okay, he is in a set of circumstances, and it could be worse because he is from all we've been able to reconstruct, at least he is confined in his own rented quarters, but he's under constant guard. He's not free to come and go. He's free to receive visitors, but he can't come and go as he pleases. Very, very limited. The kind of circumstance that that's going to challenge your peace. That's going to create anxiety. Because Paul's got stuff to do. Paul's got places to go, people to preach to. He's got churches to look in on. He's got problems to help with. And it's much harder for him to do that in this set of circumstances. And yet, from beginning to end, as he writes this letter, there's peace in his tone. And that's the kind of thing you're talking about. He is able to maintain confidence in God's care for him and God's provision for him in spite of all these weird and unpleasant circumstances that are swirling around him, in spite of a lot of uncertainty about what's going on in the future. In 2 Timothy 4, Paul is in prison. He is in a nasty place. And he writes to and he's writing to Timothy and saying, oh, this is it. I'm being poured out as a drink offering. You think Paul still has peace when he writes that? Why do you think that? You think that because you know what he says. What does he say?
He has confidence in where he's built.
Yeah. The Lord will deliver me safely to his heavenly kingdom. Yeah. Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness. Okay. That's the kind of peace we're talking about. It is and that was a really roundabout way of trying to get back to your question, Marcos, but it is a contentment rooted in the surety ultimately of God, the faithfulness of God. That's why Paul says it passes all comprehension. And like Rob said, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to the people around us. Go ahead. Yeah.
I think there's also a sense of peace that you have knowing that you're doing the right thing.
Sure.
Just that.
Sure.
So obviously, we have to find a peace knowing that God delivers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, Shane?
Well, along the lines where Marcus is talking about it, the person that tells lies, they have to remember the last lie and how it coincides with the next lie. But, you know, it's a misery trying not to get, you know, discovered in one of your lies. The person that's wrapped up in pornography has to be concerned about, you know, his computer. Someone's seeing, you know, those things. You know, if someone's having an affair, you know, they have to hide their phone. They have to be careful about, you know, the things that they say. If someone, you know, seeing a message on your phone or something like that. It's just a world of misery.
Yeah.
When you're living in sin and you're not doing the things that Paul gave us, say, to concentrate on, so there's that immediate, you know, lack of peace that you will never have. And when you do these things,
that's very good. Real quickly, Paul talks about that peace really in his own life. He calls it contentment. And he says, I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, or I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering. Does that sound like a person who's at peace? Yeah. Why? Well, there's verse 13. I can do all things through him, all these things through him who strengthens me. Nevertheless, you have done well to share with me in my affliction. You yourselves know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel after I left Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. We've already talked about their ongoing fellowship with Paul in that way. Even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs. Not that I seek the gift itself, but I seek for the profit which increases to your account. Remember, what were these gifts were to enable Paul to devote more of his time to preaching the gospel. But I have received everything in full and have an abundance. I am amply supplied, having received from Epaphroditus what you have sent, a fragrant aroma, acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. And that's the verse that tells us that Epaphroditus had come to Paul in Rome to bring him some kind of material support from the Philippian church. Remember, Epaphroditus got sick. He nearly died. The Philippians were worried about him. Now Paul says, he's recovered. I'm sending him back to you. He's probably carrying this letter when he goes back to them. But he had come to Paul bearing this support. Paul wants them to know how grateful he is for it and how it is a well-pleasing, acceptable sacrifice to God. They're doing what they ought to be doing. And my God will supply all your needs according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus. I wish we had more time, but we're out. Sunday, we start a new topic, Young Faces of Faith. We're going to look at a number of young, or at least relatively young, people we read about in Scripture. Many of these are Old Testament characters. Some you'll be familiar with, some maybe not so much. We're going to look at young people of faith. We're also going to look at some negative examples along the way. And that begins Sunday morning. There are some copies of that lesson material in the back. I know many of you have already picked that up. If you haven't yet, please be sure and grab that on your way out tonight. And we'll have that posted on the website also if you just want to get an electronic version of it. And we'll start that Sunday morning. Thanks for all your good attention, your great comments as we've been studying Thessalonians and Philippians this quarter.